Welcome back to another episode of Inside Sales. Brought to you by our sponsor, VanillaSoft, with your host, Daryl Prale. Join us each week as we interview industry experts in the dramatically growing field of inside sales, sales development. Tune in as Daryl brings you actionable strategies and tactics that can immediately increase your sales and success. So you ready? Hey, Daryl.
Thank you, Paul. How you doing, folks? This is Daryl Prale, and I am your host of Inside Sales, and I am so pleased that you've joined us for another episode. As you know, the whole purpose of Inside Sales is to get inside the role, the profession, the how-to. It is pragmatic. It is tactical. Some of our great guests we've had before include Benjamin Dennehy, Laurie Richardson, James Bodden, and with every single one of those people, they're giving you incredible takeaway that you can implement today so that you can be better and more successful tomorrow. Now, the last one I had was actually with Benjamin Dennehy, and we talked about just the whole role of prospecting, all right? And it was hilarious. He walks us through. He gives us some great role-playing. Listen to it. I've never laughed so much on a podcast. But the whole idea of the prospecting theme is critical. And that is the segue to my next guest I'm going to introduce you to shortly. But today's topic is, do you understand why you are prospecting? Are you prospecting just because that's your job? Do you understand why? Because if you don't understand why, you're not going to win. That's the theme. Today's guest, I'm going to bring him in here right now. It is Steve Burton. Now, Steve Burton is a sales manager with The Point Co. You can check him out at The Point Co, thepointco.com. They specialize in demand generation, especially around emerging technology, cybersecurity, but it's all around demand generation. And he's got an entire team of people he manages who have to struggle with this every single day. Now, he's not just a real life practitioner. He's also a pretty kick-ass sales trainer. In fact, he is the 2-time winner of the UK Top Sales Trainer Award. Steve, welcome to the show, sir.
Wow, Daryl, what an intro. What a professional you really are, sir.
You know, you make it easy when you bring the talent and the award recognition. I am totally just living off your brand and your accomplishments here. But I truly am excited about today's topic. If you're not sure of the way the process works, I get an idea in my head and I reach out for who are the right people. And I was talking to Steve about this one. Do you understand why, you know, why you're prospecting? And he immediately was like firing off ideas, you know, X, Y, and Z and all these issues and what we got to talk about. We're going to try to cram a lot today into our session. But Steve, let me come back to you. Why was this topic so passionate for you?
All right, Daryl. Well, I've had the privilege of working in quite a few countries all over the world. And what I've learned from people better than me and what I've learned from observing sales teams is if you do not know why you are prospecting, if you do not know the reason why you actually go through the grind every day, you're going to fail. Now, prospecting can be one of the hardest jobs in the world. I still do the job. I've done the job. I've managed teams who do the job. In fact, I've just walked off the sales floor. So this is just not all hypothetical teachings I'm talking about. I've been living it 30 minutes ago on my sales floor. You know, we're in the trenches doing it every day. And I feel for people because the phone gets heavy. It can be demoralizing. And unless you know why you're doing it, it can be a hard task all round. Your bosses are shouting at you. They've probably not prospected for 20 years. They want the highest of standards. You know, anyone who's doing it, any SDRs listening, full respect, guys, you've got a hard job. You're the hardest job on the sales pipeline and you're probably the most junior member. Unless you know why you're doing it and it's personalized to you, it can be demoralizing. But if you can harness that and you know why you're doing it, what's the end goal, what's the end result and why it benefits you, you can also be unstoppable and it can lead to greater and better things.
So when you're talking to these SDRs, do you actually outright ask that question at any point in the process? Yeah. Do you understand why you're prospecting and what's their reaction when you do that?
I ask it, I do it in the interview and it's my first day of training. Usually people don't know. I mean, a lot of the times they need a job, but the mum sent them here. They don't know where they're going. They think they're doing sales until they get a proper job. All these things are incorrect. You need to uncover why they're doing it. When I was 17, I started working in prospecting. I was given a yellow pages and an ashtray and told to crack on. And I was failing. I was failing miserably. I was depressed. And it wasn't until somebody reached out to me and said, Steve, why are you here? And what does success in this job mean to you? They actually sat down and I realized I wanted to go traveling. I wanted to see the world. And at that point, I then broke it down, learned what I needed to do to get there. Then all the activity, all the no's, all the rejection, it all became irrelevant because it was worse not achieving my goal than having to deal with that on a daily basis. So I ask all my people when they start. We then break it down in the training. Before we do even go into any sales training, I break it down to them and I show them that where they're going to be, how they're going to get there, and what success in this job will mean to them, what the activity will take them towards, what they need to do to achieve their personal goals, what their money will mean to them, whether it's education, whether it's progression, whether it's buying their mum a house, whatever it may be. Everyone's got different reasons. But when you uncover it and you understand it, you can track back then and work out how you're going to achieve it. So when you come in every day and you've got a mind to climb, and believe me, some of those mountains are steep, some of those phones are heavy, it just gets you through the day. And I say it, I'm a northerner, I was born in Glasgow, and someone once told me, so, you know, skill set without mindset will leave you upset, Steve. And I see it time and time again. I have these blue chip prospects landing in the office, all the skill in the world, no will, fail on day one. It's the people with the will to succeed, and you need to get that will by understanding why you're there.
I love that. Skill set without mindset will leave you upset. I have never heard that before, but that is brilliant. That is so spot on. What I also like about what you're saying, I heard you basically, you're helping these sales professionals, these young sales professionals who are trying to figure out what to do. You're making it personal for them. You're helping you're illuminating why they're doing it. It's no more a job. It's a job with purpose.
Daryl, it's purpose. It's personal for me, mate, because ultimately these young guys and girls, 18 to 25 year olds, they were me 20 years ago, you know, and I'm trying to help them. So I don't want to go down the path what I went down of failure. So if we can eliminate that, get the mindset right, the skills can be taught. The technologies can be learned. The motivation can be given. They need to grasp in their mind why they're doing it. And that's how we start before we even start the training. But that's another story. That's my sales training side. My sales management side, I need them to understand why they're here before we start.
You know, Benjamin Dennehy made a comment when we had our session where he made a comment. He goes, everybody thinks I'm just naturally good. He goes, when I began, I was awful. I was brutal. And he said the same thing. I was working through the yellow pages and I was failing miserably. I share that because here's Benjamin saying it. Here's Steve saying it. So if you're listening to this and perhaps you're a little bit disheartened, you're a little bit frustrated, you're perhaps dissatisfied with your progress so far, then it sounds like you're in the right episode. Okay. There's several talking points we want to cover today. So why don't we hop right into it? The first one you mentioned to me was you asked a very simple question. Let me frame it for the audience. Do you understand who your ideal customer is, and is your message aligned? So talk to me about that.
All right. So my customers are senior salespeople, VP of sales for tech companies, and I deal with hundreds of them. They're who I sell to. And it never fails to amaze me when they come in to do the product overview that they have one static message for the product. And when I ask them, you know, who buys your product, they say everyone. Everyone, they're always high on the product. And that's great. But people need to realize not everyone's as high on your product as you are. All right. So let's just look at the path to least resistance. If you're hot in a specific area, if it might be manufacturing, if you're hot in the financial vertical, you've got some hot case studies or some client referrals there, let's start there and work out. That's a logical place to start and work out. So let's have a tailored marketing message for those. And that can be in your outreach, your emails, your email templates, your white papers, and most of all, when you talk to people. How are you appealing to those guys? Now, let's then break that down and say 5 or 6 decision makers within these companies. Not all of those decision makers have the same pains. Let's talk about them. Let's work out how the product is going to appeal to these people at different levels. And then let's outline the marketing message. You should not be starting a campaign or an outreach campaign just blindly calling people with one set elevators pitch, which, you know, can garner some appointments. Don't get me wrong, but appointments are not where you want to be. It's ROI on sales, right? So the way you're going to do that is by working out what pains the people in the organization have. How are those pains different? How does your product solve those pains? And align your marketing message accordingly. Then start where you're hot and work out. Obviously, as you're working out, if you find some more hot verticals, hot target lists, incorporate it. Start where you're hot, work out, align your marketing message. You're going to get the better results quick, which is going to build your confidence. It's going to help your ISRs gain momentum. And ultimately, if you're in charge of it, it's going to show some ROI in your calendar straight away and allow you to get cracking. If you start off just rigging blindly with poor level meetings, one marketing message, you're going to get poor level quality meetings. You're going to get a poor result for conversions, and you're going to blame the ISR, who's some 21-year-old guy who's the lowest in the food chain. You cannot blame your ISR if you've got a poor marketing message or a poor strategy for adoption. So take responsibility at the top end and sort it out is my message.
Let's drill down a bit on that. I'm that young SDR. I'm fairly new in my career, maybe several years, but still fairly new. I don't have a lot of life experience, shall we say, in the corporate world, right? I'm still maturing as an adult. Maybe I'm in a relationship. Maybe I'm about to get married. So a lot of exciting things happen in your life as you settle into the next 30 plus years of your career. In that situation, with that youth and that lack of experience, how can they come in and determine the pains because they can't relate?
Well, you've got to work closely with your senior salespeople and your marketing teams. If you're working for a technology company, you're not going to be 21 years old and be told to dictate the marketing strategy for the organization. What you are going to do is work with the marketing team. So this is something that the ISRs, SDRs should be bringing up. Can you please give me some guidance on why the CFO or why the CTO would want this product? Why would that be different to the IT security manager? Lower down the food chain, if you're looking for an influencer, why would the analyst or why would the desktop technician be interested in looking at a demonstration of this product and why are they going to refer it on? So you need to talk to them about that. And if they start then breaking it down and giving you a massive technical explanation, you know, really, I just have to stop it there and say, no, look, who we are, why are we different and why should we care? Because these people are getting emails, phone calls, they're getting approached at conferences, they're getting invited to events 24/7 in the tech space. So we've probably been a little bit too general because this is about tech, but across any prospecting, there's always going to be a competitor. Who are you? Why are you different? Why should the person care? And why is that different? Get them to provide you with the information and then get started. If that's not there or they don't have time, well, you know, you need to be a little bit resourceful. Go to the website, look at your white papers, break it down, ask the people on the phone, what are your key challenges? What are your key pains? Build up some information, go back to your seniors and say, well, these are the challenges and pains I'm getting asked. How does our product solve those problems? And then obviously go back with your marketing message.
So it was really interesting to hear the consistency in what I'm hearing from, you know, all my various guests. Lori Richardson made a comment about one of the things you should do as a young SDR is identify a mentor, someone who's successful and go and ask them a question. And she used the word why. And, you know, why this, why this, why this? Help me understand. I'm hearing you almost say something similar. Why this, why this, why this? A lot of people are afraid to ask that question. Should they be afraid to ask that question?
No, we should never be afraid to ask. I mean, I'm a great plagiarizer. I wouldn't say I'd have a unique idea in my whole career, but I've always been good at learning from people more successful than me. And I've worked with a lot of them. So that's really helped me out. And young ISRs and SDRs, they should be doing the same thing. Now, sometimes you might see some bad habits. I don't encourage that. I mean, some people who are a bit long in the tooth might have a lot of shortcuts. Do it the hard way. Do it the right way. You know, ask those important questions. Seek out intelligent people. Sometimes the most successful salesperson in your room won't want to share those ideas as the reason why they're successful, and it can be competitive, but it doesn't hurt to ask. It doesn't hurt to ask a variety of different people. And also, look on forums, look on YouTube, reach out. There's never been more learning places to learn. There's never been more ways you can get free information. Like, look at this podcast. Someone's listening to this podcast now thinking, good idea, Steve, I'm going to do it. It's all there for you. Back in our day, you had to go and pick up a book from Zig Ziglar, read that. You know, half the people probably don't even know who he is. But in this day and age, there's loads of free advice. You can get mentors, but my advice to you is pick the right mentors. Don't take shortcuts. Learn how to do it the hard way. And obviously work a bit smarter once you know how to work harder.
I spent my first job at a school was selling photocopiers door to door. And when I was between calls, I was listening to Zig Ziglar on my audio.
There you
cassette.
Go.
So they bring back memory. Yeah. What I also like about what you said was it wasn't just the why, which is actually asking people to give you, spoon feed you the answers. Hey, do that. You told them take ownership and accountability to do your own research. So that's smashing.
Why are salespeople not life learners? Yeah. If you learned to cut hair in 1970 and never learned to cut hair style again, you'd be giving everyone perms and mullets. You won't be very successful, even though they are coming back into fashion. So as a salesperson, why are we not learning? Sales is evolving. I mean, that's one of my next points about technology. Technology changing at a rapid pace. You should be keeping up to date with the technology. I'm seeing two demos on Friday. Probably people think I'm a tie kicker. Maybe I am, but I do buy technology for my team and I do buy licenses, and that evolves and changes and I have to keep up to speed with it, right? If I was still using the same tactics I was using 4 years ago, we'd be out of business. That's the reality. All young salespeople should be learning, adapting, looking at free resources and evolving their craft. It's a craft. You meet these salespeople have been selling for 20 years. Well, they probably learned to sell 20 years ago and they've had 20 years of the same year's experience. So they've got 1 year of sales experience under the belt. They've done it 20 times. Now you should be learning and evolving all the time. I mean, I'm sat here now talking to you before having a little chat. I'm learning from you. I'm learning from stuff you're doing online at the moment. So we should all be learning from each other as a sales industry.
With that as the extra, we're going to cut the commercial break. Stay tuned. We got more Steve and more points around understanding why you are prospecting. We'll be right back, folks.
CRM was designed for managing relationships. Sales engagement is designed for starting them. Current stats indicate that sales reps only contact new leads about 50% of the time. make less than 2 attempts to contact them, and are only about 35% productive. CRM is the wrong tool to engage sales prospects. VanillaSoft is a sales engagement platform. It allows you to rapidly turn marketing qualified leads into sales qualified leads. According to user reviews, VanillaSoft will increase your pipeline and productivity by 3 times or more. Blow your quota out of the water. How? By ensuring each new sales lead is engaged within seconds, persistently, and with the cadence that is optimal for your prospects. Don't let your sales leads fall into a black hole. Take your lead engagement and sales qualification out of your CRM. Try VanillaSoft for free at VanillaSoft.com.
All right, Steve, so let's get into it now. You talked about the importance of having an effective plan with scheduled time. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've seen too many people fail. Too many people fail by procrastination, doing sporadic calling. If you have a time it's scheduled in your diary, your optimum call time for us is 8:30 till 11 o'clock every day. During that time, it's dial only. You eliminate your distractions. You turn your phone off. You turn your Facebook off. You turn your Tinder off, whatever floats your boat, and you get on the phone and start prospecting. If it's like the gym, you're not going to go to the gym and lift your heaviest weights on the first attempt. You've got to warm up. So you do your role plays, you warm up, and you get into the phone and you do your effective prospecting. The most convenient time to get through to people with your best prospects, you're going to have a higher success rate. If you pre-plan that in your diary, you're going to have more success. Otherwise, you're going to just leave it out. You know, especially if you're someone a bit more senior who doesn't have to do prospecting all day, every day. If you don't put it in your diary, you're not going to do it. Be honest with yourself. And also, if you have an effective plan in place and you've diarized it, you can look at your KPIs and results off the back of it, and you can formulate another plan if it's not working. If you're just doing it sporadically, you've got no data to go off, all right? All your data should be driven from your CRM. So if you're logging your calls or you've got some sort of automation system, that'll all be easy in your CRM. So you can watch what you're doing, how you're doing it, and just give you tangible data for your sales manager to help you out.
Classic expression, failing to plan is planning to fail. And it's all about having a plan. In fact, we actually had a whole episode with James Bodden where he goes into depth on creating a framework that works for you to be productive, exactly as Steve was just talking about. But you talked about CRM, you talked about some tools, talked about how you're still learning. You mentioned having the correct tools to help.
Before I get into that, let me just explain. Tools are not the answer to your problems. Oh, they're going to help you, but they're not the answer. They're not an excuse to why you're not hitting your target. If you're doing, first and foremost, you should be looking, am I doing the basics well consistently? Okay. Am I doing the basics well consistently? And I'm talking about asking for mobiles on every call, asking for the order, making sure you're hitting your KPIs. Am I doing the basics well consistently? If you're not, adjust that first. Now, all these tools, they're meant to optimize you. They're not meant to replace what you're doing. So go out and research tools. Yeah, you've got CRM. I would advise using obviously Salesforce with LinkedIn Navigator. You need to have the right data. Again, my advice would be to potentially look at Discover.org, something like Seamless AI. If you've not got the right tools, and the reality is a lot of your sales managers or people more senior to you, especially in the UK and EMEA, they're not going to know what these tools are. I'm lucky enough that I work with a lot of people from the States, so I get access to all this sales enablement stuff. But go out, take ownership from it. Go out and research the stuff yourself, right? Look at LeadIQ, look at Capture, look at Lusha, look at Madison Logic, use SalesLoft. Look at all these tools. Work out what are the best tools for your sales stack. Put a case together for your boss. If it's in your budget, they're going to get them. Right. If you don't have the right tools for your job, just like anything, if you're a plumber and you turn up and you've got no tools, it's going to be very hard to do your job. These tools are not meant to be replace what you're doing, like the phone. Your tools are always going to be your phone, but they're meant to optimize it. Automate where you can automate to save your time and use a human touch with everything else. That's my advice to you. But look at these things, sit demo on these things to pick the right tools for you and start using them, but do not hide behind them.
That's brilliant advice. And, you know, the biggest tool people talk about, of course, is LinkedIn Sales Navigator, which is a tool, but it's not the only tool. You mentioned several other here. Discover.org, ZoomInfo, yeah, being another comparable to that one. There's several others out there. You mentioned SalesLoft. I know you meant to mention VanillaSoft in that one.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
an honest mistake. We'll let that one go. It's, yeah, of course. At VanillaSoft, we do the exact same thing. We have a variety of tools. You know, we use our own platform for sales engagement. Right now, we're actually in a bake-off between Discover.org and ZoomInfo. So the reps are testing them out right now, see which one's better. So the tools are critical. They make you so efficient. And you're right. Do the research and advocate for your own success. Now, you talk a little bit about, as well, moving on here, about combo prospecting methods.
All right. So I'm just going to put it out there. everyone talking online about cold calling is dead, social selling this, whatever. It's all a load of rubbish, right? Combo prospecting. If you're going to war, you had a knife, a gun and a sword, you're going to take everything, right? If you've got tools at your disposal, use them all, right? I think it was Tony Hughes over in Australasia. He's a big advocate of combo prospecting. He's even got a book out on it. Now have a look at that, read it. I think the guy's been studying my sales office for a couple of years, watching me how I work, because everything he's saying is basically what we're doing, or maybe I've subliminally taken it from him. Combination prospecting, use the stuff to automate your outreach. Call people up, leave voicemails, hit them up on LinkedIn, use Sales Loft to sort your cadence out, use VanillaSoft to sort your cadence out. Go and meet people, go to networking events, ask for referrals. Why are we not using everything? So make an effective factor your time in each of those different ways of prospecting and use them all. Use them all. Why would you not? Please understand, at some point you are going to have to talk to somebody. Deals do not drop out of the sky and do not drop on your lap, right? So if you're not picking up the phone, in tandem with using your outreach tools, in tandem with asking for referrals, in tandem your Marketo and your marketing tools going out, you are going to fail. So be honest with yourself. Wake up to the fact, and why not just use everything in a measured way, logically? Does that not make sense?
Well, it's funny because we just had this. As you know, yeah. You and I were talking before we went live here. I just got off a live stream with Dan Disney, and the whole debate, it was a big debate, was around social media versus cold calling. And in fact, one of the points we made in that I made, totally in line, I believe, with what you're saying here, is I said, listen, social media is just another channel. I can use social media. I can use networking events. I can use trade shows. I can use email. They're all channels to help drive demand, to remove demand. And you're a moron if you don't use all those channels to help build your pipeline. So you are spot on. Why would you not do that? Because in the same breath, you're also establishing and building relationships. And one of these prospects could actually be your employer tomorrow. You just don't know, man. So it is in your own self-interest to do this for your short-term success and your long-term.
It's called phone fear, man. That's why people will gravitate to the easiest path of least resistance, or something they can hide behind. Use everything. Be honest with yourself. Seek out some help if you need some help somewhere. Put it all into action and you'll be ahead of the curve, especially over in the UK. And that's why we're in business.
Do not let your own fear, you mentioned phone fear, there's just as much social media fear. Do not let your own fear, your own insecurities prevent you from doing it. Just do it. Put yourself out there. There's so many people you can watch, including, of course, Steve Burton. How do you think I found Steve, guys? I found him on LinkedIn, and this man was prolific. And I love what his take was every single time. And I reached out to him because he taught me so much. That's how it works. Right. Use it all. All right. Let's bring it full circle. What are you going to action tomorrow?
That was a big point. Nothing I say is revolutionary. Nothing I'm saying is going to rot your world. But what I'll say to you, quite simply, take some action. You can talk all you want. And this is another thing where people fall down. You can talk about it. You can write about it. You can meditate on it, but unless you take action, it does not mean anything. So come into work tomorrow. If you've not got a plan, take action, put it in place. If you're not watching demos, research them. If you need some training, seek it out. If you don't know why you're there, write it down, but do something. Because if you don't change what you're doing, you're always going to get the same results. So take some action, change what you're doing, and you're going to change your results. And it's quite simple. And believe it or not, people pay me money to tell them that, and I walk away laughing because it's the most simple thing in the world, but not everyone will do it. Will you? That's the question.
Oh, he's dropping the gauntlet. I love it. So let's recap. Steve Burton, not only is he the two-time winner of the UK Top Sales Trainer, he's the only one to win it twice. I love it. His point is, do you understand why you're prospecting? He's made 5 points. Let's recap them. Do you understand who your ideal customer is, and is your message aligned? If not, ask people. Ask why, and research it. All right. Understand the pains. If you don't know them, go to marketing, go to somebody who does. It's all about focus on knowing your ideal customer. Number two, do you have an effective plan to optimize and schedule your time? Because you can't prospect if you haven't scheduled it. All right. Do you have the correct tools to help you in that prospecting? Do you understand what you need? If you need more than you got, take responsibility and ownership on actually sourcing that. Talk to others in professionals in your industry. What do they use? Why do they use it? And I'll mention that VanillaSoft's a fantastic choice there, as Steve mentioned. Use combination prospecting methods, multi-channel, I would say, omni-channel, social, networking, trade shows, email, and the phone, of course, amongst other. Don't rely upon one tactic. Don't let fear stop you from learning and discovering and developing a new tool. And finally, know what you're going to action tomorrow. Steve, fantastic. Thank you so much. Everybody, if you haven't done it yet, go on LinkedIn, send him that connection request. And by the way, don't just send a connection request. Actually say, hey, I heard you on Inside Sales and I want to connect. Make it contextual for him. You can learn more about his organization, The Point Co, at thepointco.com. He is an awesome and incredible and accomplished sales trainer. You need to follow him. From everybody here inside Sales.
What a fun night, Daryl. Thanks for inviting me on, and let's talk again sometime. Have a good one.
We're out of time here, folks. I had a blast. And that's it. We'll be back next time with another episode of Inside Sales. In the meantime, you take care, folks. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
You've been listening once again to another episode of Inside Sales, hosted by Daryl Prale, the CMO of VanillaSoft. Tune in every other week for actionable ideas to increase your sales productivity. One of the many shows on the ever-growing Funnel radio channel, sponsored by VanillaSoft. Welcome back, everybody. It's time again for another episode of SLMA Radio. If it has to do with sales lead management or sales lead marketing, it probably starts here with our SLMA weekly radio show. The show that alternates topics and hosts each and every week. Today, our guest host is Marianne Vanilla, the CEO of the Vanilla Group. Marianne's been a frequent guest in the past, and this week she sits in as our host chair as they talk about the real alignment between sales and marketing in B2B. Hey, Marianne, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Thank you, Paul.
Okay, well, welcome back. We've got you on the other side of the mic this time here, and we're here to help facilitate your conversation in any way possible. Who'd you bring along with you today?
Awesome. Well, today the title of the program is The Real Alignment Between Sales and Marketing in B2B, and our guest is Diane Updike of Updike Consulting. So during the show, we're going to talk about how modern sales teams operate effectively using tools, automation, critical thinking, and then build pipeline and get deals across the line. So I want to welcome Diane.
Hi, thank you, Marianne. It's a pleasure being here. It's always a privilege to engage with you, and it's great to be part of the Sales Lead Management Radio team. So, hi, everyone.
Yeah, it's really great to have you. And, you know, I was excited about our conversation today because your career in sales has had you on the front lines of many emerging trends in marketing and sales technology. And you said something the other day that was just spot on about three areas that this topic really encompasses. And it's really the net of what it all boils down to is marketing has to feed sales has to feed themselves, and sales has to feed back to marketing. And I know that both of us have seen platform concepts come and go. And what do you think has been the most transformative on the actual sales process?
Yeah, I would say with those three dynamics probably come three areas. And for marketing feeding sales, I'd have to say it's marketing automation, because it was a way to prime the buyer and determine which of them is a lead for sales. So it created the integration of these two disciplines of sales and marketing as the owner of the entire lead funnel. And it also just spawned this entire, you know, MarTech industry, of which there are now over 6,000 vendors. So if you out there are in marketing, I'm so sorry. So that's one. The other is, you know, the obligation for sales to feed itself. And so obviously the crux of that, especially with Dreamforce, is CRM. And it created a way for sales to be the center of its own universe. And we developed this repository of opportunities and of contacts and built this entire data store that we can now get analytics from to improve our process. So it gave the way for sales managers to actually create a discipline for sales. And then the last on the feedback, it's our obligation to, you know, send feedback back to marketing just so they can better feed us. Because if we don't do that, then we're going to miss out on finding prospects. We're not going to go into the new prospects that may be interested in us, but all the fringe testing we do of who else wants our product. And then the people that should be talking to us that just don't know about us, there's no way to get there without doing this. And so, you know, one example, I use this one product called WiseLine, and it integrates Salesforce and Intercom. But it's a way that the reps within their opportunity in Salesforce could put features that were affecting their deal. And they could put, I didn't get the deal because of that, or they could just put, you know, the customer is asking about that. And so it goes into Salesforce and it feeds automatically back into development. So yeah. They can look at that and again to put revenue aspects to the features in their decisions on what they're going to do next. But all that said, I don't think anything has been as transformative as probably what's to come. So with the IoT of things that can give us better targeted selling and just more real-time knowledge to the reps, there are things like, there was this article, if you guys want, by Buzzboard and Borel Associates, I can send it to you if anyone's interested. But how do we begin to use voice assistants like Alexa? So what if I could ask, how much does company A spend on digital advertising as I'm getting ready to go into a meeting in real time without looking through, you know, the internet and the profiles and the opportunity and all the notes I've ever taken? Well, what if I could say, Alexa, what top executives at company B are in the news? So I think the way that we'll get real-time data will be even more transformative than what has come before.
Yeah, I think that those technologies are just barely scratching the surface right now. I know I partner with a company called Balto Software, and for SDRs and account reps and really anybody that talks on the phone to their prospects, it's such an awesome tool that incorporates AI and makes for a much richer conversation. What do you think that companies can do better with marketing automation today to support what's happening on the sales team?
Yeah, probably two areas on that. One is attribution and the other is multi-channel. So, you know, attribution is attributing a marketing event or a campaign to the prospect lifecycle so that we can answer, right, how do they find us? How do they become interested? Well, that's really hard to do. Mobile companies like AppsFlyer are a little bit better of this because they're integrated with my social channels like Facebook and the mobile platforms to provide the sort of full view of how is my customer engaging or my prospect engaging with me, which kind of brings me to the second point, which is if marketers could do a better job of providing this omni-channel view of a prospect into sales. And it requires sales and marketing integration in their platforms, which I think a lot of companies do, but they don't necessarily feed all the history into a sales world to say, what are all the touch points this marketing had married with everything that I'm doing with sales so I can better understand the buyer's journey?
Right. Or they'll send it over as a lead and you've got this little snapshot of one thing that happened and you don't have a view of the whole account. And that's really important to give context to the conversation. That's something that's so important is to know, okay, what's the history within this account? What's the history with this prospect? What have they done before? And that's a breakdown. So let me ask, what are some of the things, that you see how technology can enable teams and sales and marketing to do things better together? Or how is it making things worse in some cases?
Yeah. So I'd say, first of all, that there's no common language, right? That there aren't language between the whole stages of the buyer's journey from interest to close. You know, we in sales get an opportunity and we have our stages. Marketing has different ones and it probably changes their better understanding the market. Technology is actually making that better so that we can have a full view. I'd say another mistake is not measuring the entire funnel from interest to close.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you that because at one of my companies, we found that 50% of all the deals we closed in a given quarter were people that we touched 18 months ago. So if I'm not doing that whole interest spectrum, I'm not getting that. Technology actually makes that harder because now you're integrating the technology, their ownership and political issues. I think that makes it a little bit tougher. Probably one other is just the expectations of who produces what. Right.
Yeah.
So in my experience, marketing believes it produces 80% of our leads. Sales believes it gets 40 to 50% of its leads from marketing. And it just produces these battles over, you know, which department truly created this lead. So one of the ways to counter that is sort of more process is through SLAs, through sales level agreements, where marketing will agree to give sales X number of qualified leads so that sales can then understand what's the gap between what I'm going to get and what I need to cover in quota. And so, you know, I know what activities I have to do. And then conversely, sales will have an SLA to marketing of I will respond to that prospect within, you know, depending on your business, 2 days, 1 hour, depending on and how it's run. But right. That creates the whole feedback loop.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that I've seen is, you know, there needs to be a lot of work done to better personalize information. Like I know CRM adoption is a big challenge and reps aren't necessarily entering in all the information that they've discovered in live conversations, but that information would actually help with richer content or more specific content so that you could progress your buyer along the journey better. So that fluid information sharing, it really makes a big difference for that low touch outreach. And I know CRM adoption is a challenge on a lot of sales teams. What have you found to be the best foundation that organizations can have in place for user adoption and compliance?
Yes, I have lived this one greatly. I will tell you, yeah, I've got this one. So it requires two of the following three things to happen. One is, any two of the following three, but one is that they'll do it just to keep a manager off their back. So I find I can manage my team to 5 or 7 metrics to put in. I may monitor more, I may review more, but I may not hold them accountable, because if you do it too many, then it becomes the burden of input and you might get nothing. And so, for example, I'll have a dashboard, a team dashboard that shows deals that have been forecasted but have had no activity for the last X number of days.
Right.
You know, like, for instance, 21 days. And so they will know, okay, then our discussion is about what can we do to move that up or off. The second thing is if the rep finds benefit, right? So I'll give you an example. There's a product called PlanDoc, and it allows the reps to create proposals.
What's it called?
With PlanDoc.
Yeah.
Within the CRM. But it's only if the rep has filled in the right fields in order to do that. So the proposal will be generated, and it will be tracked, and they'll know if it was viewed or forwarded. All the comments get fed back automatically back into the CRM so that the rep has one place to go for the opportunity and so for all the dialogue. So because it saves them a ton of time, it gives them the whole proposal history, they're more likely to fill out the fields in CRM. So that's the second one. And then just the last one is if it's easy and seamless, if they don't have to do notes twice, once during the meeting and another in the CRM, right? Because then they just put shorthand in the CRM and don't give the full color. So if any of those, you know, two of those three happen, they're likely to adopt.
Yeah, exactly. And those are some great recommendations. What are some of your favorite tools for sales teams that are out right now?
Ooh, so you're talking about like software, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, software tools. So it depends on whether, you know, you're a manager, right, or you're a sales rep. So for managers, my favorite right now is Gong. And what it does is it records the calls. And so what it allows me to do is I always say, oh, I'm going to go on 5 calls this week with my reps. And then, you know, it just all gets in the way with meetings and fires and everything else. So, okay, I'll go on 3 calls. But what it allows me to do is listen to calls on my own time. So I'm still engaged in what you know, how the rep is describing us, what the customer is saying, what are the key points. It takes it records it, but it also structures it, parses out keywords. I can view how much we talked versus they did. I can look at patterns in all of our descriptions. And so it's also a good training tool for new reps. So that's one for managers. For sales, let me parse that out real quick, and it depends on the role. For SDRs, I think they need an outreach cadence that allows multiple touch points. Like, I'm going to send an email, I'm going to make a call, I'm going to do a social interaction.
Yeah.
And for those, you know, I like SalesLoft and Outreach.
Yeah.
And then the last one for enterprise reps, probably 3 quick areas I'll say. One is nudge.ai, which is relationship intelligence. How do I get to someone to have the conversation? Just the classic of Zoom Info, which tells me about companies and contacts. And then discover.org for identifying projects and indicators that someone and the timing might be a fit for my company. So those are some of the newer ones. I know there's also more classic ones like LinkedIn, but let me turn that back to you. What are you finding?
We're going to break for a commercial right now, and okay. Then we'll come back and I'll give you a few of the ones that I like working with also.
Okay.
Okay, and you can start putting together your own mental list of the ones you like working with. But while you're doing that, before we get back, we just want to remind everybody that for 18 years, the Vanilla Group really is the only firm offering expert, high-quality B2B telemarketing and telesales-based sales lead generation. It's designed for large deals, little deals. Anybody can benefit from it, maybe even you. Their methodology is exclusively developed for the level of engagement needed for enterprise tech companies. Their telesales 2.0, which is a trademark model, is unmatched for delivering active sales leads, meetings, and real pipeline development. They engage as a peer with executives, they gain access to opportunities with stakeholders, and they uncover critical, and we're talking about critical, opportunities that you may be missing. For all that and more, simply go visit thevanillagroup.com, just like it sounds, VanillaGroup.com, VanillaGroup.com. All right, I'm curious to hear now. Marianne's going to come back with her list.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Paul's an awesome producer. There's a few things that I really like right now. I really like Inside View. I think that's an excellent tool. I like Balto Software. I think that they're really onto something. Seamless.ai is awesome. Quarterly AI is another awesome new platform coming out. So there's a lot of things that are emerging right now that are really going to be game changers. So let me ask you this, Diane. How have you partnered with marketing teams that you've worked with to make sure that they're supporting reps with the right enablement tools? So like competitive info, market information, industry knowledge, things like that.
Okay, so you're talking about more not software tools, but the
right.
Armed with weapons, so to speak.
Yeah, that they can get in there and deep dive right away.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. That really is where sales enablement as a role comes in, because it bridges marketing to the field. And it's really the qualitative side of that sales and marketing relationship. And you just talked about some of the key weapons, I think. Competitive info, which is always changing. Industry knowledge, so that especially if you're doing any kind of account-based marketing, or we can get closer to the subject area and the problems of our customer. And I'd say the other key one is objection handling. That is the thing that is hard, always changes, requires a comfort and experience and referencing from a rep that just requires rote practice over and over. I'd say that was key. And the other thing is they need to, it changes so rapidly that there needs to be a constant feedback loop for that. Because, mm-hmm. right, because the revision. So they create, you know, they're, things are constantly changing in terms of the marketplace and your tool and so forth. But having that feedback loop and revision and then a way to educate back to the field in a usable way just can't happen unless someone is dedicated to it. Otherwise, all that lags.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially, you know, their competitors are going to change. They're going to add features. You've got to be aware of that. You can't go in and talk about something that was applicable a year ago. So there has to be a continuous effort to make sure that what they have is current, and the objections will change as the platform environment changes. So, and I know one of the things, you know, that a big breakdown that I've seen is you've got all these sources generating leads. So, you know, it could be shows, it could be downloads, it could be, you know, whatever it is. And it all kind of nets down to a link in the CRM. So mm-hmm. what do you recommend sales management does to ensure that their team does their homework on prospects before they call them, make sure that they prep for engagements? What are some easy things that they can do to have some continuity around that?
Yeah, so there are tools that we can give them, but, you know, it's really up to the rep and all the action is up to them. And if they have a passion about the subject, they will do it. Some of the things that they can do, but it's still, again, up to the rep, is social stalking. right? Every one of the person, you know, every one of the prospects to whom they'll talk has some kind of social footprint. And so begin to get on their profiles and understand and like their tweets. And there's a lot actually that you can tell about how somebody creates their profile on LinkedIn that will help you in the sales process. And I won't go into the details on that. The other thing is industry networking. We don't go to our subject, you know, marketing automation. We go to whether it's retail federation or banking or whatever the subject area is, go to where those prospects are.
Right.
And then it's staying company, staying current on their company news and, you know, published reports. But for the long term, one of the best things they can do is especially enterprise AEs can build his or her own brand. They can share, they can publish, they can contribute, they can be part of the conversation. And there's tools like Buffer and tools where as I'm reading an article online, it'll put it into a repository and allow me to easily, you know, socialize that out later. And there's a bunch of tools like that. But in the end,
Buffer.
It really is the responsibility of the rep.
I use Buffer. I love Buffer. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and another thing too, another tool that I wanted to mention is I think LinkedIn's done a great job with Sales Navigator, because that's another thing that can help you really be granular on your searches for finding your prospects. Because, you know, that's the thing, is you have to be specific, because from a leadership standpoint, to keep that consistent customer experience, because on the back end, you know, you can have all these tools and automation and training, and, you know, marketing is doing a lot of activities, but all of it all nets down to what the customer experiences when you reach out to them. And, you know, they don't necessarily know all this other stuff going on behind the curtain. It's really a very noisy space for the prospects with all this outreach going on. So I know as a CEO, I get a ton of outreach, and I can say that a solid 90% of it is bad. So, you know, how can executives have visibility into what's happening on the front lines and be able to influence that so that they're really maintaining a quality touch at every stage? What are some things you're thinking of?
Yeah, I mean, there's two aspects to that, right? There's what is the individual preference, which you can never know, right, until you're engaged with them. But also, what is the data showing is the general impactful point now, like, you know, how much cadence and how long. So on those two things, and you were talking about, we're talking about how we engage the customer when they're a prospect, right, for consistent experience?
Yeah.
Is that? Okay. Yeah. So
being
so
smart about it.
Yeah. The only way is testing and communication, right? Really. So you've got to test. So for instance, for cadences, how much is enough? And you're not going to know unless you are organizing your outreach and have a way to look at the data and see, and it constantly changes about how much. I mean, I'll know, like we know that I did some studies, but, and read some studies that it takes 12 times for a rep, an enterprise rep, to reach out before they'll even get the attention of someone else, right? So don't stop at 5 and we'll go, oh, you know, the rep's bad, or that's not working, or they don't like our message. So knowing some of those facts by doing cadence testing helps. Another thing is, and these are just small tactical things, but share your marketing calendar, not just events, but when are we doing some branding events? When are we sending out a campaign? So it's up to the marketer to publish that and make that in one single source, but then it's up to the rep to constantly look at that and use that to his or her advantage in their sales cycle.
Yeah. So everything's not in these silos. So let me ask you this, because we've only got a couple of minutes left. If you were going to recommend like three things right now for sales VPs to do today to make sure that they have full visibility of their sales organizations, what would you say that they do?
Yeah, I would say one is field work, which means manage the ratio of how much you're in front of the desk versus behind it. Because if I know what customers are saying, I can propagate that to my team. That's one. Yeah. Number two, I'd say know why you lose. At the end of every quarter, I make 3 phone calls to deals that we lost. I ask 5 questions to keep it very simple. And I understand, you know, how did my team operate? What was interesting about us in the first place? You know, why did you choose something else? Various questions. And probably the third thing is, man, I got to have 2 more real quick. So I would say communication. If you have a remote communication and culture beyond just your headquarters organization, when you have a remote organization, it is a culture and a consideration for everybody, not just the people that are remote. And I'm going to throw one more in there. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Let me ask you this.
No, you
What's the best way that people can reach you right now?
Right now, it's honestly through LinkedIn. I've been getting most of my business through word of mouth, but I'm actually publishing a book on building a sales team. It goes to the publisher today. It'll be out early November. And with that, I'll have a website, examples, and a different email address to reach me. But right now on LinkedIn, Diane Updike is the best way.
Okay, that's excellent. Hey, thank you so much for doing this. It was awesome. And I'll hand it back over to Paul and everybody. You know, please connect with Diane, and I will look forward to seeing everybody soon. Back to Paul.
You've been listening to another episode of SLMA Radio, right here on the Funnel Radio Network for at-work listeners like you. Welcome, everybody. It's time again for another episode of CRM Radio Today. The one show taking a look at the ever-changing CRM space today and tomorrow with our host, Paul Peterson from Goldmine. Hey, Paul.
For our listeners, Paul Roberts heads up to OC Talk Radio at octalkradio.net. And in addition to syndicating CRM Radio, also numerous other business topics. So you'll want to check that out. And we're part of the Funnel Media Group, which was Jim Obermeyer and Sales Pipeline. We were a frequent guest, on his shows. And so today is more of the inmates taking over the asylum. What do you think, Paul?
I think it's high time.
All right. So the idea here is, and I've been in technology and CRM space, sales and marketing, for some 40 years, amazingly. In our travels, we run into very interesting people who are either talking about CRM or marketing and aspects of it. We love to sit down and chat with them. And so the CRM Radio Show gives us an opportunity to have that conversation so that you can listen in as well. Contact information at the end, of course, so that you can ask your own questions. And so we'll have topics that range on big policy, big picture marketing, to sometimes your tactical things around technology and CRM. Full disclosure, I'm the general manager of Goldmine. Been around since 1989, one of the first central databases that many companies used, and we've been in the CRM space for a long time. One of the pioneers, as Stacy coined it. And so today we have an interesting show because our guest is Stacy Gentile. He is my marketing manager, global worldwide operations, and has been with us about 3 years for the Goldmine brand. And Stacy had a career in the U.S. Army, degree in international relations, and then moved on to the exciting world of marketing consulting, marketing automation, and has worked with over 300 leading brands on helping them get better exposure. And in particular, has been helping us in the Goldmine space. Stacy, welcome to the show. Get to interview a colleague here, but you were part of the Forbes online community, asked to author an article recently that just got published, The Three Technologies Small Businesses Need to Prioritize for Better Cash Flow. And so kind of an interesting angle for a marketing person to be talking about cash flow. So tell us a little bit about, you know, how the article came about. What prompted you to talk about the cash flow aspects?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, my background's been heavily into marketing, but also sales as well. And I've worked with a number of startup businesses, ran my own startup businesses, worked on some difficult turnarounds in my past, and also, as you mentioned, I worked with large enterprises as well, 300 of the largest American brands. I think cash flow is always important, especially when you're an SMB, right? I mean, cash flow is everything. That saying, cash is king. I'm sure you've heard that before, right?
Sure.
Cash is absolutely king. And I think when you're a younger business and you're starting up, it's so easy to fall into the trappings of the excitement of starting your own business. I know I've kind of been there before, and you get excited about the idea of grandeur and how you're going to get all these clients and how you're going to make all this money and how you're going to hire employees and treat them and what furniture you're going to pick out or what colors you're going to paint the wall. And I think a lot of those ideas that get into the entrepreneur's head, kind of distract them away from the grind, right? And that's where this article kind of came from, is just trying to help those entrepreneurs or early stage small business owners to take a step back and realize that the core of their technology helps them do the grind. And it's not the sexy part, it's not the fun part, but it is the part that you have to pay attention to make sure that you've got cash flow.
Your many businesses, as you point out, get started with the idea and getting things going, and they don't look at building out that infrastructure. And there was actually a little bit of a surprise in I'll call it the order of the list. You list out three technologies. Why don't you share with what your thoughts were and how you
sure.
ranked them?
Three primary technologies that I mentioned in the Forbes article was having a CRM system so that you can organize and leverage the data. That's got to be number one. And not to mention also with CRM platforms and systems is that everything typically integrates into those. So it is really the legitimate center of the technology hub. Secondly, then, is financial software, right? You have to be able to manage your P&L, your balance sheets, your AR, your AP, all of that stuff. Because if you don't have insight into that, invoicing, boy, you're going to really be in trouble. So a financial system, typically like QuickBooks or QuickBooks Online, that's probably the most popular. And then thirdly, mass communication tool. Because if you're just sitting there in your office and you can't talk to people, that's not going to get your business going, right?
Right.
You got to have some kind of digital communication system like a Constant Contact or something similar to that, or a marketing automation program that you have a speed of communication, that when you want to communicate an offer or you want to communicate with your employees or you want to communicate with partners, that you can quickly just grab a bunch of people, send them a message, and get it out the door.
In the old days, I would have put a telephone system as the communication mode, right, that inbound. But what you're talking about is a little bit more of the outbound message that says you can't be passive about that and wait for the phone to ring.
Right. Well, I mean, try calling somebody. I know that in the organizations that I ran in the past, you know, we used to have like inside sales reps and they would make 100 calls a day and they maybe get a hold of three people. That number may even be worse today. I don't know. It's been a while since I was with any SDRs directly, but all communications these days is typically digital or social.
Part of that is a topic maybe for another show, but about creating inbound marketing. That's the, you know, the outbound marketing things that how many times
right.
have you and I gone to clients and other businesses where they said, we want to talk to people, we want to help them. They won't even talk to us on the phone. They want to do it. They'll call us when they're ready, sort of thing. But let's go back to the three technologies. So I was kind of surprised that CRM was on top over financial systems, because you all think, oh, getting bills out and financial statements is, you know, core, but you listed CRM as first. So why did you think that ranked higher?
You know, I think like anything, they all work together. Like it's a three-legged stool. You take one of those legs out and you're gonna fall on your face. So I don't know if they really rank higher than one another, but for sure, like I said, the CRM system sits at the center because the financial system and the communication system integrate into it. So I guess if we had to give them a priority, I would say CRM does sit at the middle because things integrate into it, not the other way around.
Sure. And so how does that help with the managing the cash flow, which was the sort of painted a dire picture in the article, which everybody should read, of course, but that cash flow can kill a good idea, and that CRM can be a critical success factor in managing cash flow. So why don't you walk us through a few examples of how that's so?
I'd look at it this way. Okay, your financial system, let's just say QuickBooks, it doesn't make you money. There is nothing in that financial system. Well, I suppose it organizes your invoices and helps you send those out. But it's like reading a ledger. That's what it does. Your CRM system, on the other hand, makes you money. Every time a customer calls, you see all their data, and it gives you prompts that you can talk to those customers about. So it's more of a revenue machine because it's helping you do your marketing. It's helping you communicate. It's helping you stay organized. It's far different than what you get out of your financial system. One of the examples I would give, we've all been to Vegas, right? You look at those high-end casinos, they know everything about their customers. They know who the low spenders are. They know who their whales are. Why is that? Because they've got CRM systems. They not only know who their whales are, but they know when their birthday is. They know what their favorite food is. They know what rooms they like to stay in. They know what their wives, daughters, you know, what their birthdays are, what their favorite foods are, where they like to go shopping. They have all of that sitting in their data. And when they can leverage that data, that's where they start making their revenue. The companies who understand the data and leverage the data are the ones that profit the most, clearly. And that goes across all industries. A couple years ago, well, there still is this big push for big data, right? And I think when people think about big data, they start thinking all this artificial intelligence and all these complicated things. But SMBs can leverage data in the same fashion, just on a smaller scale. And I think like that example of the casino really plays into that. So the more data that you can put in and keep it accurate, train your employees in a culture where they can leverage that data and use it on a daily basis and keep it clean, the better you can do that, the better off you're going to be in a position to make more revenue, clearly.
Right. And it feeds into the one of the overall benefits of CRM that we've seen, right? That if you have that database, many companies will follow up on a phone call or a lead with somebody that first time. If the customer's not ready, they put it aside. You don't get back to it, right? So a database, CRM, allows you to store those and go back to them, so you don't have to try to catch the same fish twice. You've got them in, you can nurture, market, and so forth. So you talk about communication and reaching out to the customers. What are some of the best practices then of reaching out with mass communication that help cash flow?
Well, here's an interesting correlation: is you have to identify how you're going to create these systems in the beginning, because you want to create them with the end goal in mind, right? Because if you want to do something with a communication and you don't have that data in the system, you can't do it, period. It's just a roadblock. It's a brick wall. Bang, it's not going to happen. So if you wanted to run some kind of communication campaign, say, to a selected group, if you can't identify it in the CRM system, you just won't be able to send it out. So, for example, let's go back to the example of the casino. Let's say that the casino wanted to run a marketing campaign to everybody in Louisiana because, I don't know, let's just say there was some bad weather coming, and they said, hey, everybody in Louisiana, why don't you leave Louisiana's bad weather and come experience a nice desert atmosphere here in Las Vegas, and we'll put you up and all this and that. And it's a simplified version, but if they can't go into the database and identify all their potential customers from Louisiana, that's just never going to happen. And the more custom fields that you can build in there and identify it, so maybe it's not only people in Louisiana, maybe it's people in Louisiana who have a personal worth of over $2 million, or maybe it's everybody in Louisiana that has a personal net worth $2 million and also stayed on the top floor in the penthouse, right? In the casino. So the more data that you have in the system, the more that you can leverage it and then target your message directly to those folks. And that's how you generate more of the revenue.
Having the right people to go into, it's very often salespeople will focus on the clients that they like to talk to and the clients that are active, and you don't forget about those people, what I'll call below the line. We're coming up on our commercial break, and we're sponsored by Goldmine, Goldmine CRM, so we're going to listen to that.
You know, you rely on your CRM system, and it's usually a love-hate relationship. Most CRM systems, well, let's face it, they're expensive. They're hard to understand. People don't use them properly. And you're probably paying for features that you don't even want. If that's your case, then maybe it's time to simplify. It's time to get more from your CRM. Why don't you go back to the original? Trust Goldmine. We helped pioneer the industry, after all. Goldmine CRM is, well, it's simple, it's affordable, and it's proven. If all those sound appealing to you, if you're just tired of the CRM headaches that you're getting from trying to implement something that's just too complicated, too expensive, and too much for you to figure out, then why not go back to the original? Visit Goldmine today, goldmine.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking with Stacy Gentile about the CRM systems in particular being an important technology layer to put in first. A lot of times people will wait. So why is technology such an afterthought in small businesses? I mean, you touched a little bit about the excitement of chasing after the, you know, product development cycle, but, you know, in general, even companies that have started are slow to adopt some technologies. And why do you think that is, Stacy?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the technology end of it isn't as sexy as wall color or furniture or the grandeur of how you're going to, you know, grow your business. It's the grind. it's oftentimes as well hard to implement for the culture. The technology stuff is complicated and expensive. It's sometimes a headache, especially when you're trying to integrate all of the systems. So any number of those things can have small businesses go off the rails. If you look at the economy right now, the economy's doing great, right? Going like gangbusters, unemployment is super low, GDP is everything by all economic factors look good, but that's on a macro level. When you look at small business failure rates still, they haven't changed. It's flat. So clearly there's something happening at the SMB and startup and entrepreneur level that is not indicative of the economy. And that's just because they're missing the grind and they're losing out on the cash flow.
Have you identified some warning signs that say a startup business should start to look at technology to help them through some trouble areas or to stabilize?
Well, you know, I think when you look at the reason for small business failures, I think a lot of the leading analysts always want to point to bigger things, right? So they point to maybe that company had a bad go-to-market strategy, or their product was off and there was a lack of interest, or even low capitalization. Now, while all three of those are good things, it just comes back to, I think, culture and leadership around that technology. I'll give you a case in point. Is the other day, again, it comes back to, you can have all this data in the system, but if you're not using it the right way, things go off the rails. So the other day, believe it or not, one of our competitors called me and tried to sell me a CRM system. I was like, hey, are you looking at your sales sheet right there? Look over my job title. And he goes, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I've done that as well. In fact, I called them back and said, hey, I'm a competitor just checking out your site, and they still called me back.
Right. So I think it's those types of things. When you have the data and ignore it or don't look at it or leverage it in the right way, that's when the wheels start to come off as well. So sometimes it's not only having it, it's having the training and the culture from the human side of it to use that data. Or make sure that it's clean. You've got to have that technology culture from the people using the technology.
As we get towards the end of the show here, why don't we walk through and spend a little time on what are some of the things that a startup business or a business, I'll call it early stage, you know, the 1 to 3 years, what can they do to get started with the three technology pillars? What do you recommend?
Well, I would say build the system with the end in mind. You're going to realize that you need the three-legged stool, the CRM system, the financial system, and the communication center, right? Now, when you're building all of these, be careful not to overspend, especially at that S&B, knowing that cash flow kills 85% of those businesses that won't make it to the five-year mark. You've got to keep an eye on cash. So don't go out and buy a system with stuff in it that you don't need, right? Not feature overload. You need feature rich, and keep an eye on the money. And the next thing is not only think about the technologies and how they're integrating, but like I just mentioned, focus on building that leadership and that culture and how you want the people to use those three systems. And then once they're using it, you know, have regular meetings about how you're going to optimize it, how you're going to clean it up, what was working, what wasn't working, what new things do you have to put in, what things are you going to take out, how are you going to add on to it and make it better. And then one of the other keys to it, especially, you know, talking about the CRM systems, is you have to develop a process to kill bad data entry early. Because if you've got garbage in, you're only going to get garbage out. See, I think a lot of people also think that technology solves all your problems. But if you've got a mess and you put technology on top of that mess, all you're going to have is a mess at light speed.
You've got to try to clean bad data faster.
Right, you'll just have bad data faster.
There are a couple of other elements, too, that I think enter into it today with the privacy and GDPR and other acts that using a product, you mentioned Constant Contact, there are other email providers, but making sure that you're managing your email lists to avoid any liability issues there is more important even for a smaller business, so that they don't get hit by that. The other aspect you talked about, setting goals, right? We have people who sell to customers once, but what they use their CRM system for is generating referrals, or they respond to those leads quickly. I can't tell you how often people will say to me, if you respond to a lead quickly, that wow, that doesn't happen often. And then the other is if you're a B2B in a repetitive system, you need that database, right, to continue on, you know, the track of developing recurring revenue and keeping in touch with people who aren't buying now but who could buy later. Stacy, we're coming up on the end of the show. So you know, we got three technologies to look at, some tips about not overspending, and setting good goals early on to help maximize. Financial system is a great way to collect the money, but you need that CRM system to help drive the revenue. So, Stacy, where can they read the article, and how can they reach you if our listeners have a question or two or a comment for you?
Well, you can find the article on Forbes just by searching under my name. It's Stacy Gentile, S-T-A-C-Y-G-E-N-T-I-L-E. You can also find me on Twitter at StacyGentile.com.
All right. I'm Paul Peterson, the host of CRM Radio, so appreciate your comments. You can reach me, the general manager of Goldmine, and we hope you heard some tips today for your business. I can be reached at paul.peterson@goldmine.com. And in closing, I will say, enjoy the day. Surf's up.
You've been listening to another episode of CRM Radio Today. Part of the ever-growing list of shows on the Funnel Radio Network for at-work listeners like you. Welcome, everybody. It's time for another episode of Sales Pipeline Radio. So grab your board and ride along as we bring on our host, Matt Hines. Hey, Matt.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Sales Pipeline Radio. Thanks so much for joining us for another episode. We are here live every week, Thursday at 11:30 Pacific, 2:30 Eastern. For those of you joining us on the live show, thank you very much for joining us each week. For those of you joining us on the podcast, thank you for finding us. Thank you for subscribing. We are available. You can subscribe to make sure you catch every episode on the Google Play, on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, and everywhere fine podcasts are found. And every episode of Sales Pipeline Radio can be found past, present, and future on salespipelineradio.com. We every week are featuring some of the best and brightest minds in B2B sales and marketing. Today is absolutely no different. Very, very excited to have with us today Weldon Long. He is the CEO of Weldon Long, and he is the author of the new book, Consistency Selling and the Power of Consistency. Weldon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, Matt, thanks so much for having me. Very excited to chat with you today.
So tell me a little more about your background. I mean, I've been following you for a long time. I'm sure a lot of other people have as well. And so talk a little bit about sort of your journey and sort of where you, how you've become really one of the nation's most sought after and influential speakers and motivators in the sales industry.
Great question. And I think, you know, kind of my background is relevant because it's so much about how sales changed my life. I was a ninth grade high school dropout at 15 years old, kind of running the streets. At 23 years old, I was high on drugs and up in Denver, Colorado, and was involved in a robbery with a guy that I picked up hitchhiking. So at 23 years old, I found myself doing a 10-year stretch in the penitentiary system. I did about 4.5 years on parole. Got out, didn't have an education. I was still a high school dropout. Now I was a convicted felon to boot, so I ended up going back to prison. In fact, I went back two more times. And between 1987 and 2003, that roughly 16-year period, I spent 13 years walking prison yards. But it was on that last trip in 1996 that my father passed away, and I had kind of my epiphany, my moment of clarity, and made a decision to change the course of my life, which is exactly what happened. I had 7 years left to serve, but I devoted my life to studying business and sales and taking responsibility for my life. In January of 2003, I walked out of prison to a homeless shelter, and within 5 years had built an Inc. 5000 company, wrote my first book called The Upside of Fear, and since then been writing and speaking and teaching people the lessons that I learned, not just out of my personal life, but the sales principles that helped me grow that sales organization, which really completely transformed my life.
So for people that don't know you and don't know your story, probably listening to this for the first time, let's unpack that a little bit. It's one of the most amazing stories that I've heard in the industry. I mean, not only just sort of the turnaround, but the speed of that turnaround. What are some of the things that, you know, when you were in prison, you discovered that really sort of were the cause of that turnaround? I mean, it's pretty amazing to see, to hear that kind of a focus and dedication and having someone come out really shot out of a cannon and doing some pretty amazing things. How did that happen?
Well, when my father died, it was on June 10th of 1996. I was 32 years old. I was in that third prison sentence. And when my father died and I realized that he went to his grave knowing me as a thief and a crook and a liar and a punk, it completely devastated me. I also, by that time, had fathered a son on an earlier trip out on parole. So I had a three-year-old son that I didn't know. I had a father who was gone and deceased. And I made a decision I was going to change the course of my life, become a man my father could have been proud of and a father that my son deserved. So I began to study and read. The first book I picked up was The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And that began this journey of hundreds and hundreds of books that I read on business, leadership, personal development, et cetera. And the real lesson that I learned, Matt, is that my life was a reflection of my habitual thoughts, for better or for worse. You know, the subconscious mind is a powerful force and a relentless problem solver. The problem is it's a lousy judge of character. It will solve problems and based on information that's very negative, the same as the will for very positive. So I realized my life, my pathetic life, was a reflection of my thoughts and my habitual thinking. So I wrote out a list of what a perfect life for me would look like. I wrote on that sheet of paper, I'm an awesome father to my son. I'm a successful entrepreneur. I have a beautiful home on the beaches of Maui, a beautiful home in Colorado, all these amazing things. And I took that sheet of paper and stuck it to the wall of my cell with toothpaste. And I spent the next 7 years meditating on that list and visualizing it. I didn't realize at that time the neuroscience was going on in my brain, but it fundamentally changed my thought process and the things that would dominate my thoughts and therefore my actions and, of course, ultimately my results. And 7 years later, I walked out and my mind was completely rescripted, and I did have that force of nature called focus, right? It's a powerful, powerful force, that thing we call focus. And I just, you know, battened down the hatches, got myself by the bootstraps and went to work and haven't slowed down in 15 years.
That's amazing. We're talking today to Weldon Long. He's the author of the new book, Consistency Selling, and we're going to get to that in a little bit. But I want to talk a little bit about sort of how and why you chose sales. I mean, like, you know, there's a lot of places you could have gone in terms of focusing your life, coming out, being the father and the man in the profession you wanted to be. What was it about sales that really sort of caught your attention and drove your focus?
Yeah, as I often say, Matt, really sales chose me. I didn't have many options. I'm living in a homeless shelter in January of 2003. I'm out walking the streets of Colorado Springs, Colorado, where I live, and I'm knocking on doors. And for 6 months, I knocked on hundreds of doors. And given the fact that I had no experience, I was 40 years old by that point, no work history, I had a criminal record, I had all these things working against me. And after 6 months of knocking on doors, I happened to knock on the doors of a little heating and air conditioning company, which I knew nothing about. I still really don't know anything about heating and air conditioning per se. But the guy needed someone to run residential sales calls. He said, "Can you go talk to people and run these sales appointments?" I'm like, "Well, I'll die trying." And I went out in July of 2003 after 6 months of looking for a job. I'm still wearing an ankle bracelet, an ankle monitor from the parole department. And I start running sales leads. And I found out I was really good at getting people to like me and trust me and let me solve their problems. And by that point in the story, by the way, too, a big part of my transformation was a total dedication to living my life with honor and integrity. I learned from Dr. Stephen Covey that if you want to be trusted, you got to be trustworthy. And so, you know, my value system had changed as well. And so people, I think, felt that authenticity. Fortunately, they didn't feel my desperation at the time. But I went out my very first month. I sold $149,000 of air conditioners at what I call kitchen table sales, you know, in-home residential sales. Made myself about $14,000 in commissions and just never looked back. So really the sales profession chose me because I was desperate for anything. And it turned out that I was pretty good at it as I began to study and implement a lot of the things that I had read in prison. I studied, you know, Brian Tracy and Tom Hopkins and all these great thinkers and writers, and many of whom became great friends over the last 15 years, which was, you know, very ironic. Tom Hopkins, in fact, Tom wrote the foreword to my second book, which was called The Power of Consistency. Dr. Covey, before he passed away, endorsed my first two books. And ironically, on this third book, Consistency Selling, Stephen M. R. Covey, who wrote The Speed of Trust, mm-hmm. Dr. Covey's son, has written the foreword for the new book. So I feel like I'm just along for the ride. I tell people I'm enjoying the ride. I'm riding the wave, but I did not create the ocean.
You know, a big focus for you is habits and consistency. Talk a little bit about why that's been so important to you. I think we certainly see it a lot in sales and marketing, and you know, even as early as late as last week, working with a group of salespeople, sales and marketing folks last week at a workshop, spent a lot of time talking about the power of habits, the power of consistency, and you know, the fact that sometimes you just come in and you put your hard hat on and you do the right work and you do the work on a regular basis. Talk about why consistency has been so important for you personally, as well as for what you've seen in success from those that you're teaching and training.
Yeah, another great question. And it really is twofold. The consistency principle is twofold. The first one is pretty obvious. Consistent sales results come from consistent sales activities. Random sales results come from random sales activities. It's not really rocket science, right?
Right,
one of the
right.
definitions of insanity that I love is finding something that works and then stop using it. And I think in sales, we're all guilty of having a sales process that we follow. It generates results. And before you know it, we're cutting corners because, hey, look how good I am. And we don't realize that we're kind of eliminating some of the fundamentals that made us successful in the first place. Sales process is really simple. To me, it breaks down to four things. I use the acronym of RISC, R-I-S-C, instead of K on the end, but R-I-S-C, build a relationship, investigate the problem, solve the problem, and bring the deal to a conclusion. That doesn't always mean to bring it to a close, by the way, because we won't close 100% of our deals. But we can bring every sales call to a reasonable, logical conclusion. And so those fundamentals that we all practice that make us successful in sales, sometimes we can start eliminating. So the basic principle of consistency is do the same thing every single time, and you will generate consistent results, whatever your process is, when you find one that works. But the second part of consistency, I think, is even more important. And when I kind of integrated this second concept of consistency into my sales process, both in my personal sales process and my companies and what I teach, is the principle of consistency as kind of defined by Dr. Robert Cialdini, who wrote the Influence books and Persuasion books. And the consistency principle rests on a simple proclamation that public declarations dictate future actions. In other words, we tend to do the things we say we're going to do. So I figured out in sales real quick, I read an article by Cialdini in American Scientific Mind. This was 14 or 15 years ago. And he talked about some studies about having people make certain declarations, certain proclamations, and they tend to act in a manner consistent with that. So it occurred to me, what if I could get my customers to acknowledge to me that price was not the most important factor, that they don't need to talk to my competitors, and they can decide today whether or not I'm a good fit for themselves and their family or their business. If I could get them to make those public declarations, they would be more likely to take actions consistent with that at the end of my sales process, which, of course, was to buy from me. And I can, if we have time, I can give you a few examples of that because it's very simple and it's extremely powerful.
I love it. We're going to have to take a quick break here, pay some bills. We'll be right back. More with Weldon Long. He's the author of three amazing books. Quite honestly, I would recommend them all. The first book, The Upside of Fear, tells a little more depth his story. The Power of Consistency, his second book, and his new book, Consistency Selling. We'll be right back on Sales Pipeline Radio.
In a world where the speed of innovation and change in B2B marketing has never been greater, the only thing bigger is the need for clarity, for a blueprint, for a guide to what's really working. And how about a way to apply it specifically today to increase sales pipeline growth, velocity, and most of all, conversion? That's what you'll find in the Modern Marketer's Field Guide. And amazingly, you can download it for free. HeinzMarketing.com, just like it sounds, HeinzMarketing. It encompasses the entire sales and marketing cycle, but in quick bursts with lots of specific, actionable ideas, strategies, tactics you can put to work right away, like today. The loaded table of contents helps you narrow in and tackle a problem, and it's something you can come back to over and over again as a reference guide. Why not download your free copy of the Modern Marketer's Field Guide? It's free. HeinzMarketing.com, just like it sounds. H-E-I-N-Z, marketing.com. All right, let's pick it back up with Matt and his guest.
Welcome back to Sales Pipeline Radio. Thanks very much for joining us today. We are very, very honored to be joined by Weldon Long. He's the author of three amazing books. I highly recommend them all. The first one, The Upside of Fear. The second one, The Power of Consistency. And I want to spend a little time talking about consistency selling. I feel like, you know, over the last few minutes, you know, you've kind of been doing a little preview of the book itself and talk about what you wish for and what you need to do from a habit standpoint. Talk a little bit more about what that means and give some examples to kind of bring that home for folks just in terms of why consistency in habits and focus is so important.
Yeah, and that's what it all comes down to, right? It's making us more effective, more productive in our sales jobs, our sales professions. And by the way, your listeners should know, if they text the word videos to 96,000, they'll get a three-video series that's going to explain in detail what we're fixing to discuss. Or they can go to weldonlong.com, and there's a big button they can click there to get those three. It's a series of three videos. But when it comes down to consistency selling, again, based on Cialdini's work, that people that make certain statements tend to take actions consistent with those statements. In other words, Matt, if you said, hey, Weldon, can you pick me up at the mall at 3 o'clock? And I say, sure, Matt, I'll be there at 3 o'clock. And I look down at my watch and realize it's 3:15. Right? When I realize that I forgot, I get that anxious feeling that psychologists refer to as cognitive dissonance. It's anxiety because my actions are not consistent with my words of picking you up. When I feel that anxiety, what do? Do I ignore it? No, I turn the car around, I call you, I do something to get myself back to a state of resonance so that now my actions are consistent with my words. It's very powerful research, and you can read Cialdini's work. He's written several books. But it occurred to me one day that in my sales profession, I tended to hear the same three or four objections every single day. I want a cheaper price. I want to think about it. I got to talk to your competitors. I want a different brand, right? I used to get them every single day. It would make me crazy. I got to thinking, listen, I know what's coming before my prospect knows what's coming. So what I did is I got the idea. I went out, and at that time I was selling heating and air conditioning systems. I went out and I found two reports. One was from Consumer Reports. The other was from the Department of Energy. And basically what they said is that when you're buying a new heating and air conditioning system, that price was not the most important factor. Proper sizing, a trustworthy contractor, warranties, guarantees, these were all more important than a cheap price. So I incorporated both of those articles into my sales process. And early on in the sales process, I would share that information with my prospects, with my homeowners, across the kitchen table. And then once I had them read the reports and we discussed it, I would ask a very simple question. Mr. Prospect, would you agree or disagree with Consumer Reports and U.S. Department of Energy that there are several factors to consider here that are as important, perhaps even more important, than a cheap price? They just read the articles with me. It came from third-party experts, Consumer Reports, Department of Energy. They had no choice but to say, well, sure, we just read it, right? So now an hour later, I get to the end of my sales process. They made the statement that price is not the most important factor. Well, that influences their behavior. When they start thinking about price at the end and they're thinking about asking me for a discount, they know that we've already had that conversation, either subconsciously, maybe even consciously they remember it. But here's the most powerful thing, Matt. If they change their mind, if they do a 180 on it, and all of a sudden they say, well, now you're $1,000 higher than the other guy, I can use what I call the three most powerful words in sales. Earlier you said. And I respectfully and politely always remind them of what they told me an hour earlier. I understand, Mr. Prospect, we're $1,000 higher. But, of course, quality is going to cost a little bit more. And earlier you said that you agreed with Consumer Reports and Department of Energy that price was not the most important factor. Has that changed in our time together? And when you remind them of their previous declarations, they're going to feel that dissonance because now their behavior is not consistent with their words. And just like I got nervous when I forgot you at the mall, they start getting anxiety when they realize, wow, I did say that earlier, and I did agree with that. In that moment, they become more likely, not 100% of the time, but they become more likely to take actions consistent with their previous declarations, which were price is not the most important. You can see the implications of that on the sales process. So that's how we use the principle of consistency as defined by Dr. Cialdini to influence the actions of other people. And yeah, there's a great controversy about, you know, is this manipulation or is it influence? And Dr. Cialdini describes in his books that if the outcome is mutually beneficial, it's influence. If the outcome is only beneficial for one party, well, that's not exactly a proper motive. But if you know you've got a great company, you know you'll do a good job for this prospect, then it's a mutually beneficial outcome because they don't know your competition like you do. They don't know that they could trust your competition and maybe get ripped off.
Talking today on Sales Pipeline Radio again with Weldon Long, author of the new book, Consistency Selling. And if you'd like to check out some of the videos Weldon mentioned, text videos plural, to 96,000, or you can certainly go to WeldonLong.com and learn more about his books and get his blog and get those free videos as well. You mentioned earlier in our discussion sort of the subconscious mind, and I want to talk a little bit about that. I think early in my career, I tend to think, you know, subconscious mind and some of that stuff's a little bit woo-woo, but the more science I've read on this, there are certain things you can absolutely put to work to get your brain to really work harder for you. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned and what's in the books that sort of really help people empower that subconscious mind to their own benefit?
Yeah, because you're right, Matt. That is the key to the kingdom as far as I'm concerned. When you get a mindset that is programmed to prosper in the face of adversity and pursue its goals, you have the keys to the kingdom. When my father died and I was in prison, I realized that my life was a reflection of my habitual thoughts. Then I realized I needed to change my habitual thoughts. So I wrote that list down, as I mentioned. I put it on my wall, and I begin to review it every single day. Just like you, when I first started reading about this, and probably the first recollection I can remember thinking about it was from Napoleon Hill and Think and Grow Rich, where he talks about imagine yourself already in possession of these things. And at first it seemed a little mystical to me as well, a little woo-woo, as you put it. And I needed something more practical. So I started studying some of the neuroscience behind it, and it's a very simple factor. Remember our old friend, cognitive dissonance? Well, it works for us individually, too. Just like public declarations dictate future actions, guess what? Private declarations also dictate our future actions. So if I read what I call a prosperity plan, to write out everything you want, everything you need to do on a sheet of paper, review it for 15 minutes a day. If I'm reading that sheet of paper and it says on there, I earn $300,000 per year in my sales career, I run every call with passion and purpose, I diagnose problems and recommend solutions like a boss, and I ask for the order every single time. And I visualize myself running sales calls like that. I visualize the income, the outcome of the income for myself and my family. Then a few hours later, I go out and run my first sales call. And let's say I go in, I very quickly drop off a cheap price and walk out hoping my prospect will call me next week. Well, all of a sudden, I'm going to feel dissonance. Why? Well, because I told myself this morning that's not how I run sales calls. And so what happens on the next sales call, we're going to remember that feeling. And guess what? We're going to start driving the behaviors because the dissonance, the anxiety feels so bad. Right? So the only way to get rid of the anxiety, well, there's two ways, but the most productive way to get rid of the anxiety is to do the thing you said you would do. The other way, which is not especially healthy, is to tear the plan up and never review it again, right? And therefore, there's no accountability. So it's not woo-woo, it's not mystical, it's basic application of neuroscience that if we tell ourselves we're going to do something, we become more likely to do it than if we had not said that to ourselves. So if I get up in the morning and I never consider how I'm going to run a sales call, then I go drop off a cheap price, guess what? There's no anxiety because I never made statements to myself that were, you know, the opposite of that. So it's the ultimate in personal accountability. And by the way, your listeners and The Power of Consistency, that book is completely about that whole process, about the neuroscience. It's a very simple book. I tell people my books are very simple to read because they were written by a ninth grader. They're not complicated books. But I have had neuroscientists contact me after that book came out and said it was the simplest explanation of the neuroscience behind success they had ever read, right? And there's a lot of research that I've learned since then. But to me, it's just simple common sense stuff.
Mm-hmm. Love it. We're wrapping up here with Weldon Long. Definitely make sure you get a copy of his new book, Consistency Selling. If nothing else, check out his videos on the secrets of implementing the prosperity mindset in consistency selling. You can find those at WeldonLong.com or you can text videos plural to 96,000. Well, then at the end of almost every interview we do here on Sales Pipeline Radio, we ask people who are some of the folks that they have really learned and been inspired from. I feel like this entire conversation has really kind of encompassed really the answer to those questions. So I might change it up a little bit and say, you know, in addition to your book for the modern seller, for the modern business professional, who are some of the current authors or other current books that you recommend people check out to continue to make themselves better?
Well, the first one, and I don't know if it comes under the category of current, it's relatively current, which would be The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I tell people Dr. Covey saved my life. He didn't change my life. He saved my life. That book was the roadmap for how to live a life and how to build a business. Currently, Robert Cialdini, I'm a huge fan of his books on influence. It talks so much about what drives our own behavior and what drives the behaviors of our customers. I think that his work is super, super important. And then I would look back probably, I wouldn't say recent, but I would look at some of the classics. Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. I would think I'm sitting here right now looking at Og Mandino's The Greatest Salesman in the World. The tried and true and tested philosophies that withstand the test of time. That to me is the most reliable stuff. Sales, there's a lot of different sales philosophies out there, and it just depends on the individual. Listen, any of them will work if we apply them on a consistent basis.
Right. Right. I want to thank our guest again, Weldon Long, for joining us today. Really appreciate all of your insights. Your story is amazing, and I'd highly encourage everyone to check out the book Consistency Selling. And if you want to learn more about Weldon and his story, definitely check out his memoir, The Upside of Fear. We will be here next week for another episode of Sales Pipeline Radio. Make sure you join us each week at 11:30 Pacific, 2:30 Eastern. And every episode, including this episode with Weldon, will be available at salespipelineradio.com. For my great producer, Paul, this is Matt Hines. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Sales Pipeline Radio.
Yes, indeed. You've been listening to another episode of Sales Pipeline Radio, brought to you by the good folks at Matt Hines Marketing. Welcome back once again to another episode of WVU Marketing Communications Today, a live show right from West Virginia University that sits squarely at the intersection of data-driven decision-making and marketing practice. And the man who'll make sense of all that for you is on right now, Lee Silverman. Hey, Lee.
Hey, thanks, Paul. I am your host, Lee Silverman, and we are happy to have you with us for our discussion on the persuasion code. Is there really part of the brain that decides? Most of our attempts to persuade are doomed to fail because the brains of our audience are wired to automatically reject messages that disrupt their attention. Most people believe that persuasion is more art than science because there has not been a single complete scientific model of persuasion. Today, we will learn that persuasion can be linked to brain science and that the primal brain of your audience drives their decision-making process. We will also discover what can stimulate that primal organ and how this translates into critical questions needed to address and maximize the probability to persuade. Joining us momentarily is our guest, Patrick Renvoise. Patrick is the co-founder and chief persuasion officer at SalesBrain. He is an expert in complex sales, and his background includes having been in charge of business development at both Silicon Graphics and LinuxCare. While marketing supercomputers and multi-million dollar software solutions to some of the world's most brilliant scientists at NASA, Boeing, Shell, Airbus, BMW, and more, he became fascinated with the human brain. Patrick began investigating a scientific model to explain how humans use their brain to make buying decisions. He spent 2 years researching and formalizing the first 100% science-based persuasion model called NeuroMap. In 2002, Patrick and his business partner, Dr. Christoph Morin, co-authored the first book on neuromarketing and published NeuroMap. This proprietary, award-winning methodology has been used for the past 16 years to help over 6,000 companies worldwide scientifically persuade. Patrick, we're so happy to have you join us. Welcome to Marketing Communications Today. Let's jump right into this. Tell us about the primal brain and why this should matter to marketers.
For a long time, we thought that, you know, the decision-making process was made by one banded organ. But a few years ago, researchers started to realize that we don't have one self, we have two selves. There is on one end the rational us, and there is also the primal us. And researchers like Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in Economy in 2002, were able to demonstrate that in reality, the decision-making process is driven by our primal self, by what we call the primal brain. So what's been really critical for us to realize is that that primal brain follows some rules of rationality. In other words, we make irrational decisions, but there is some rationality in how irrational we are. So the whole purpose of our work is to establish some rules of rationality to explain how this primal brain works.
Okay. So as you mentioned, rational decisions, is it true that humans rarely make rational decisions? And can you tell us more about cognitive biases?
In fact, another researcher by the name of Dan Ariely wrote a book called Predictably Irrational. And there is no such thing as a rational decision. It does not exist. In fact, one of the greatest experts on the world of decisions and emotions in the brain is a professor. His name is Antonio Damasio. And Damasio demonstrated that we make emotional decisions and then we rationalize them, not vice versa. So again, there is no such thing as a rational decision. There are 188 rules of irrationalities, if you want, and we call that biases. Rule that explains how and why we make these irrational decisions. But again, what is new that we're revealing in our book is how to connect those rules of irrationalities with a simple process that everybody can follow if they want to maximize their capacity to influence others. So maybe I'll give you one example of these rules of irrationalities or the cognitive biases. In fact, the one I'm going to talk about is one of the oldest, and it's called the recency primacy effect. Here's what happens. If we were rational decision-making machines, and if our brain was processing information linearly, we would remember things linearly. In other words, if I was going to give you a list of 10 words, there should be no reason for you to not remember the words in the middle. However, because of that rule of recency primacy, if I give you a list of 10 words to remember, you will tend to remember the words at the beginning. That's the primacy effect. At the end, that's the recency effect. And people will tend to forget everything in the middle. And this has implication. I'll give you a very famous quote from George Lucas. George Lucas, famous movie maker, said, if you want to make a good movie, you want to create a hot opening, a hot close, and just don't screw up in the middle. That's what he said. And if you are a business person, how can you use this to your benefit? Well, what that means is, for example, we've all heard that you have only one chance to make a first impression. Yes, that's the primacy effect. You know, it's so hard to overcome that first impression that you make on people. And think, the last words that you're going to say are going to be more present in the mind of people. So you have to be really careful in how you close your arguments. So again, this was just one simple example, but we have 188 of those rules of irrationality. So again, what we're revealing in our book, and to my knowledge, this is the first time that it is done through a complete scientific model. We are explaining, we are linking all these rules of irrationality, and we are helping people. We're providing a simple step-by-step process that will maximize your probability to use all these biases to your advantage.
Okay, that was a beautiful illustration as well. Very easy to understand with the beginning and end being paramount. I understand that neuroscientists and neuropsychologists have known about the primal brain's role in decision-making for about two decades. Why has this knowledge not really reached the business world?
Two separate worlds. On one hand, you have the world of academics. These are people that spend a research budget, that are looking, I think they write books, they get other people to get their PhDs. It's one world. And then there is the world of business. In fact, you know, today there is about 70,000 books on marketing. There are 90,000 books on sales. There are about 20,000 books on neuroscience and neuropsychology. Defines all this. Our objective in life is to create a bridge between those two worlds, which do not communicate very well together.
Okay, and it sounds like there's very fertile ground for this in those who are doing marketing and better understanding this primal reptilian brain that we all have. In mentioning, as you did, books being out there, in your book you also talk about neuromarketing. What can you share with us about that?
So about 15 years ago, we started to see a new branch of marketing called neuromarketing. And what we do in neuromarketing is, we ask people, what do you want? But we're not going to pay attention to their self-reported measures. Instead, what we will do is we will measure directly on their bodies various physiological changes. And those physiological changes allow us to poke directly into their unconscious, if you want. It's an unfiltered version of what people truly want. So we use different modalities to do that. Some modalities include we measure how people's skin changes resistance. In other words, when people get excited or when they get sad, it changes the resistance of your skin. We also measure the emotion that people are displaying, not again based on what they say. Instead, we measure it based on how they contract the 43 muscles on their faces. We measure their change of tone of voice, because your voice is controlled by a very specific area of the of the brain, and it takes a professional liar to not change his tone of voice as he's lying. We use EEG, we use EKG, so we use all these different modalities to get a much better picture about people truly want, and that's what neuromarketing is.
Well, that's really fascinating. And thinking about marketing and other tools that have historically been used, if we think of focus groups, if we think of surveys, interviews, these things have the potential deficit in which someone could be doing us lip service and trying to tell us what they think we want to hear, perhaps as opposed to what they're thinking, or maybe they don't even necessarily know what they're thinking. But these tools you mentioned seem to be able to measure and unlock what's really there, whether they're aware of it or not, if I understand correctly.
Yes, it's using a direct way of doing these measurements as opposed to using people's self-reported measures where they have a hard time to express using words what they really feel about a product. And as you said, there is another aspect, which is we know also that, for example, you know, imagine if I'm going to answer a few questions about Coca-Cola. We know that people tend to give the answers that the questioner is asking for. In other words, we know people try to please the people that are questioning them.
Well, I think if I understand from Paul correctly, we're looking at taking a break and we'll be coming back here in just a few moments. So please stand by for us. We'll resume our talk with Patrick Renvoise on the Persuasion Code.
All right. And as we digest all that information he's been giving us here, on a brief mention about West Virginia University's online data marketing communications program. It's the first graduate program of its kind, focusing on strategic thinking, critical problem solving, and informed decision making. The data marketing communications program prepares you for your career by learning those innovative tactics from award-winning faculty and leading thought leaders like our host and our guest here today. You can learn more at dmc.wvu for West Virginia University. dmc.wvu.edu. All right, you guys are in pretty deep here. This is some pretty heavy stuff here. I'm my pen is running out of ink. I'm writing so many notes down here. We'll pick it back up.
This is our talk on the persuasion code. Is there really part of the brain that decides? And our guest is Patrick Renvoise. Patrick, we've talked about the importance of the primal brain in marketing, but how does one reach it?
So we've established that those 188 cognitive biases can be summarized into what we call stimulus, and we found six of them. In other words, because it's a brain that's ancient, it's a brain that's approximately 500 million years old, and if you want to compare it with the rational brain, you know, the rational brain is only about 5 to 10 million years old. So this primal brain is really ancient, and because, you know, internet did not exist back then, those stimulus, there are only six simple ways you can stimulate that brain. So let me review them very briefly. The first one is, it's the brain that is expecting a personal stimulus. In other words, it's a brain that is completely selfish. It does not know compassion at all. It's a brain that's all about me, me, and me. The second stimulus is contrast. It's a brain that needs contrast to decide. And here is what happens. You know, a typical brain processes about 11 million bits of information per second. Unfortunately, you can only focus your attention on about 50 bits per second. So how do you decide among 11 million bits per second which one you're going to pay attention to? Well, you use contrast. You know, an example of this is if you're driving in the night and everything is dark and all of a sudden a light flashes on your right side, instantly, almost like a reflex function, your head will turn towards the flashing light. Why? Because there is a lot of contrast between that flashing light and the dark around. So it's telling your brain, well, there is a potential danger there. I have to put my attention there. Right? So to trigger that primal brain, you need to have contrast in your stimulus. Third stimulus is tangible. Tangible, that means that it's a brain that only understands very down-to-earth, very simple stimulus. For example, it's a brain that does not understand something like, we are a leading provider of, and we provide easy-to-use, scalable, modular architecture. Why? Because all these concepts are highly intangible. In fact, it's a brain that the expert also called the pre-verbal brain. It's a brain that works that appeared way before we started to use words. You know, written words are only about 10,000 years old. spoken words are about 50,000 years old, and that primal brain is 500 million years old. So it's not even the same scale. So it's a brain that does not even, doesn't even understand words. Why? Because words are not tangible enough. And that's the third stimulus, tangible. The fourth stimulus is it's a brain that is visual. So, you know, we've known this for a long time. A great portion of all brain activity is actually about processing images. And if you look at the architecture of the brain, apparently we had eyes before we had a rational brain. In fact, a lot of animals, most animals, have eyes. And that means that the primal brain existed, you know, has been existing for a long, long time. And that optic nerve is actually very fast. The optic nerve in the brain provides about 50 times the amount of information that the ear is bringing to the brain. So fundamentally, the brain is an image processing machine. So making your stimulus visual really helps your audience understand what you're talking about. The next stimulus is beginning and end. So just like I talked about the recency primacy effect, that particular bias translates directly into one of the stimulus. In other words, when you communicate with people, they will remember the beginning, they will remember the end, and they will forget everything in between. And finally, the last stimulus is emotion. In other words, if you communicate with people with purely rational information, and there is absolutely zero emotional component to it, people will have a really hard time to decide. So again, there are only six ways you can trigger or you can stimulate that primal brain. And this is a direct application of the 188 cognitive biases that I talked about.
And as you mentioned the aspect of contrast, I had the pleasure recently of watching your TED Talk, and I would urge our listeners to search for this on YouTube if they haven't yet seen it. And there were some beautiful examples of contrast on there that the audience was just struck by, as well as I was. So having only six ways or stimuli that can reach the primal brain, what does it mean for savvy marketers?
What we've done is we've translated further those six stimuli into four steps. Now, I will review briefly those four steps. But the first step is you have to diagnose the pain of your audience. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to take a very, very simple example to illustrate all these different steps. So imagine you're trying to sell water. Most people that are trying to sell water, they start by talking about the water, how fresh the water is, how pure it is, etc. But the best and most effective way to start to influence an audience is not by talking, but it is by listening to the people, and it is about listening about what we call their pain. And their pain are going to be conscious or unconscious negative emotion that your audience experiences. And the notion of diagnosing the pain, you need to do that because fundamentally that primal brain is personal. It's selfish. It only cares about me, me, me. So again, if you're trying to sell me water and you start by talking to me about your water, you display a very selfish behavior. Whereas if you start to ask me, oh, you know, what are you thirsty for? And you have a headache. Maybe you need to drink more water. So if you show me some level of compassion, if you start to ask me questions, if you put me at the center of your discourse, then I will be willing to open up to the idea of starting to buy from you. So the first step in our process, diagnose the pain. Then the second step, and again, you need to do that because that primal brain is personal. The second step is about how do you use contrast? And the second step is you need to differentiate your claims. Because here is what happens. If you're selling water, most likely you have competitors that are also trying to sell the same water to the same customers. And if the customer does not see the difference between your water and all your competitors' waters, then you're not maximizing your probability to sell. So you have to find something different about your solution. And you have to find that difference at all cost. So I want to take you to another example here. Now, let's imagine you're trying to sell home-delivered pizza. What do you think is the number one pain of people who buy home-delivered pizza?
Wow, I'm guessing hunger.
Well, hunger, interestingly enough, I would not call it a pain. I would call it a need. In other words, people are aware that they're hungry, right? That hunger drives our behavior, but it's almost at the conscious level. But there is something at the unconscious level that drives people's behavior to buy home-delivered pizza even more predictably. And let me tell you a story. 35 years ago, there was a small pizza shop in the area of Detroit. And when they tried to figure out what was the number one pain of the average consumer of pizza in our country, they discovered that that pain was the anxiety of not knowing when the pizza would arrive. As a result, they chose a slogan, and their slogan was 30 minutes or less, or it's free. And as you recognize, that little pizza place is known as Domino's, and they became number one in the business. Now, they didn't become number one in the business because they made the best pizza. They became number one in the business because they identified the pain, and then they built a complete organization around that notion that they would be the best at eliminating that pain. In other words, the pizza is not the business. The pizza is just an accessory to the business, and Domino's is a FedEx organization. So that's the pain. And what, again, what now is the claim of Domino? Well, Domino's claim is not so much about the quality of the pizza, but it's about their promise that they will deliver it to you in 30 minutes or less. So the claim of Domino's has nothing to do with the pizza itself, but it has everything to do with how quickly they will deliver it. And why did they choose this? Because they realized early in the development of the company that the anxiety of not knowing when the pizza will arrive, which is, again, as you can tell, it's a deep emotion in the brain of the audience, that that was driving their behavior. So it's the second step. After you've diagnosed the pain, you need to differentiate your claim. And you need to do that, again, because that, that reptilian is sensitive to contrast.
Yes, yes. And that differentiating yourself from competition is so important throughout marketing, of course. To shift gears for a moment, in the remaining time that we have, why is it so important to have a scientific model of persuasion?
Well, it's important because, first of all, then you can apply a process. In other words, you can get much better, much more predictable results in what you do. So that's the positive side for the marketeers. Now, for the consumer, it also is very important because that allows the consumer to be way more educated about how other people are trying to influence them. I mean, I've been doing this for over 20 years, but I still find myself from time to time making completely emotional decisions. So when that happens, I analyze why is it that the message of that particular person was able to get to me faster and more effectively than anybody else. So being able as a consumer when people are trying to manipulate you is critical. So again, you know, just like in physics, physicists are trying to unify all the forces in the world. And they're trying to come up with one single theory of how forces work in the world. And being able to do this for sales and marketing, I believe, is equally important because it will make sure that people no longer buy stuff they don't need.
Okay, very good. Well, in brief, would you like to mention the book that you have out if others would like to pick up a copy and check it out?
Yes, so the book is titled The Persuasion Code. I am one of the co-author with my friend and partner, Christoph Morin. And the book is available on Amazon. It's available in many other places. You know, the book was about 2 years in the making, and it's a sequel to our first book, which was titled Neuromarketing, Understanding the Buy Button Inside the Brain. Again, it's a book that is all about science, so we're not asking people to trust us. We're giving people scientific facts, and then they can make the decisions for themselves. But our conclusion was that, you know, even though we are in 2018, we still make completely irrational decisions. By making sure that people can learn about how irrational we believe that we can make the world a better place.
Well, that's wonderful, Patrick. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. This has been The Persuasion Code. Is there really part of the brain that decides? And I think the answer to that is yes. Paul, I think we go back to you, my friend.
You've been listening to another episode of WVU Marketing Communications Today. Boy, we're stumbling through this one here today, but hang in there. Right here on the Funnel Radio Network for at-work listeners like you.